Dead friends come and go, but enemies remain and build up. Winston Churchill apparently said, "You have enemies, good. That means you've stood up for something at some time in your life." In 1930, Al Capone, mafia mob boss, was branded public enemy number one in the U.S. city of Chicago. We are looking tonight at a psalm that is all about the assault of an enemy. The psalm begins in verses 1 and 2 with a spoken plea to God by David for protection from his enemies. In short, we could summarize his plea as, "O God, hide me from my hidden enemy." He says, "Preserve my life," and then goes on to say, "by hiding me." And we see his enemies described in three ways. We have first the enemy, singular, and then we have the wicked, those who are wicked, and then we see it's a throng. There's a whole host of evildoers. And the reason I say hide me from the hidden enemy is because, as you see in verse 2 there, we're told the enemy is secretly plotting. Now, if we see verses 1 and 2 as the sort of headline of the news story, well, then it's verses 3 to 6 that fill in the details of the story. We've been introduced to the enemy, the wicked, the evildoers. Verses 3 to 6 tell us what these enemies are like and what exactly it is that they do. So let's look at these four verses together, verses 3 to 6. They're filled with the imagery of warfare, of attack. We read of swords, of arrows, of ambushes, of shooting, and the laying of snares. But actually, what seems to be of greatest concern to David is not any physical attack, not the thrusting of a sword or the stretching of a bow. The main instrument these wicked, evil-doing enemies are using is not their arms to swing a sword, but it's their tongues. Four times we see the language of speaking in these verses. Look at verse 3, it says, "They whet their tongues." Again in verse 3, "They aim bitter words." Then in verse 5, "They talk of laying snares." And in verse 6, "They search out injustice, saying." So this is not so much about the assaults of enemies as much as it is the insults of enemies, the verbal attacks, the preparation, the plotting. The enemy is one who is talking and plotting. And this leads David to be in dread of the enemy. Rather than any physical wound that he's sustained and he's thinking, "I wouldn't need to cry out because I've been injured." No, it's the dread of the enemy because of what he's heard them talking about. And this taps in to human experience that I'm sure nearly all of us here can relate to. The power of words. Words build up or words tear down. The children's rhyme, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never break me," is so, so terribly wrong. For while bruises and bones can soon heal, it is so often the case that words spoken many years ago, when remembered, can stir up painful emotions. Maybe even as you sit here tonight, you can recall words spoken to you, words that hurt, words that called you pathetic or stupid or worthless or a whole host of other unkind, damaging, tearing down expressions uttered about you or to you. For some, maybe you received this in a consistent way over many years, maybe from a parent. For others, maybe it was during your school life. Maybe it's in your marriage or even from your children. There are likely to be many victims here of harmful words, but there are as likely to be just as many perpetrators as victims. Maybe as you have received harmful, hurtful words, so now you give them out. Maybe to a lesser degree, but still, nonetheless, there's a struggle with words. We all have a struggle with words. Proverbs 10:19 is on point when it says, when words are many, sin is not absent. When words are many, sin is not absent, but he who holds his tongue is wise. We speak so much, it is hard to take stock of all the words we say each day. Research suggests that on average, women speak about 20,000 words a day, while men speak about 7,000. So women speak maybe three times more than men, but still, 7,000 is a lot of words to take account of. And as Christians, Ephesians 4:29 commands us concerning our words to let no corrupting talk come out of our mouths, only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. And that's not just a challenge for Christians not to use swear words, but for all of our words to be said in order to build people up. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we're always called to be nicey-nice. As you think about it, a good solid structure, a building needs to be built in the right way. If there's shoddy workmanship, it needs to be removed and replaced. Sometimes correction is needed, but the aim is still to build up. And same idea with the idea of a fruit-bearing tree. It needs pruning, cutting away in order to be more fruitful. But it's the motive behind the words that we use. And this is such a complex issue. And the reason being is because it's such a big issue. 20,000 words, 7,000 words, whatever it is you're in between there. And James recognizes this when he says, "For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle his whole body." Talks about if we put a bit in the mouths of horses so that they obey us, their whole bodies go as well. Or he talks about ships, with they're so large, and yet a small rudder directs their course. Or he talks about a small fire setting ablaze a whole forest, and the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. This is serious. Words said in anger, words said in haste, words said without thinking can have far-reaching effects. Tissue left in a pocket for laundry makes a big mess. Tissues are useful, helpful little items. You keep it in your pocket when you have a cold. There's a proper use for it. On occasion, I have been doing laundry and I've forgotten to check one of my pockets. Normally always do it, but it's just so happened that there's one tissue in a pocket. And I imagine you can already think of the mess. When the wash is finished, you open the door and there's white little fragments all over the washing machine, falling onto the floor as I take out the load, and it's all over the clothes. Hang them up to dry and then spend a considerable time picking off all the little pieces of white fragments, shaking it, trying to get rid of it, then hoovering up the mess from the floor. In the end, it seems like there was a whole box of tissues in the wash. Checking the pocket would have taken 1 or 2 seconds, and not doing so leads to maybe an hour of clearing up the mess. Well, the tongue is a little like that. It's such a small thing. It's useful and helpful when used properly, but if used wrongly, which only takes a second, it can cause a great mess. The consequences far outreaching the initial action. Words are potent. Words can lead to dread, as we see here with David in Psalm 64. And we've considered some of the Bible's wider teaching on the subject. Now let's look at what exactly David is getting at here. What are the types of words he is so distressed by? The first image used of the wicked's use of the tongue is that of the sharpening stone. These evildoers whet their tongues like swords. This is something done in advance. Swords are not typically sharpened in the heat of battle. So it seems the words that David is so concerned about are those which are premeditated. Sharp swords so that they can be incisively destructive, as incisively destructive as they can be. We've already been told in the opening verses that the enemies are involved in secret plots. The idea of plotting suggests a group planning harm, discussing how best to bring about someone's downfall. We think gunpowder, treason, and plot, the attempt to bring down a government. Well, the wicked in Psalm 64 are plotting the king's downfall. They're preparing their words to bring maximum damage when the time is right. The second image used there of the wicked's use of the tongue is developed more than that of the sword. It's the image of bitter, destructive words being like arrows shot from the archer's bow. And there's four ways these arrows are shot, we're told. We're told, firstly, that they are aimed. In other words, they have a target. And the target we see in verse 4 is the blameless. The blameless one. The arrows are shot, then, secondly, from ambush. Now, the two key factors about an ambush is it's the hidden position. There's a hidden position from which the ambush is launched. And secondly, it leads to a surprise attack. So it's from a hidden position, and there's the surprise nature of the attack. The attacker lurks in a hiding place from which he aims his words. Thirdly, we're told that suddenly they shoot their words. And that, again, connects to that idea of ambush. It's a surprise. It's sprung in a moment. And then fourthly, we're told that these words are fired, they're shot without fear. And again, that connects to the ambush idea, because the people who are firing them are hidden. There's no fear of reprisal. This is not a fair fight out in the open, a man-to-man duel. No, this is an attack from a distance. The enemy thinks we'll stay out of range of the enemy, we'll just pick them off from a distance, and we'll be nice and safe over here. These are the enemies set against God's king, plotting the destructive use of their words to bring maximum damage and have no negative consequences for the enemies themselves. And then verse 5 tells us they are unrelenting in their evil plan. They will not be deterred from their wickedness. We see the idea of laying snares secretly. They want to set booby traps that they are nowhere near when they go off. They do this at night when no one else will see what they're up to. The plan is that their victim will be left completely unsuspecting. We even get a glimpse of their inner thoughts when we read in verse 5, thinking, who can see them? These evildoers think that not even God will interfere with their twisted plans, because he is not actively interested or involved in the rights and wrongs of this world. And maybe that's what you think as you witness injustice all around you. Maybe that's what you think as you not just witness injustice, but you're maybe in the midst of experiencing it. You feel like God doesn't care about you. He isn't really interested or involved in all the problems of your life, whether that's from the smallest frustration of a typical day, breaking a fingernail, right to the biggest setback, like getting the news that you've got a major debilitating disease, or wherever you are in between on that spectrum. And you know you're not alone in thinking this, for it's a theme we see in different Psalms, particularly Psalm 73. The question along the lines of, oh God, why do you allow the wicked to prosper and the righteous to suffer, the righteous to go unrewarded? Maybe that's what you're thinking. Well, here in Psalm 64, we see the wicked plotting and scheming. Verse 6 tells us they want to get to the very bottom of just how deep they can go in their injustice. They go right to the depths of the darkness of the human heart in their search for injustice and evil. And here's where we see the connection between the human heart and our words. We looked at what Ephesians said, what James said about our tongues and our words, but it's not just a matter of being careful in what we say. The problem lies much deeper. Jesus said, it is out of the overflow of a man's heart that his mouth speaks. So we've got to the depths of these enemies' evil, their evil attempt to bring harm to the king through their plotting with words. Well, then in verse 7, we move from the focus on the enemy's bitter arrows to God's arrow. We read, "But God shoots his arrow at them. They are wounded suddenly." And then verse 8, "They are brought to ruin with their own tongues turned against them." Here comes the answer to that question of why do the wicked prosper? Why do the righteous suffer? God's just judgment is certain. So while evil may triumph for a time, God will respond. He will punish his enemies in the most appropriate way. In Psalm 64, the enemy's chief weapon we see is the tongue. And we see here their downfall is that their tongues are turned against them. And this isn't the only example of this treatment of judgment in the Bible. We see a number of biblical illustrations of this principle. In Deuteronomy 19:19, we're told about witnesses bringing charges against someone, and these false witnesses, if they're found to be false in their accusations, the very penalty that they wished on the person they were accusing, they would receive it. Maybe more well known, we think of Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel, who sought to be faithful to his God, who was then envied by all of the other people in positions of power, who sought out the king and said, "King, let the people only worship you. Let them not worship other gods." And so they wanted to catch Daniel, and they reported on Daniel and said, "Daniel, he's guilty. He needs to be thrown into the lion's den." And then we see Daniel preserved in the lion's den. We see the king recognize Daniel's God as the true God. And in the end, all of those who plotted against Daniel, who wanted him in the lion's den, they ended up in the lion's den in his place. Another example comes in the book of Esther. We think of Haman, servant of the king there, plotting the destruction of the Jews. He didn't know what was coming for him. He had been invited to this meal with the king and Esther. He came out all happy and glad. But then he saw Mordecai sitting and Mordecai refusing to bow to him. And he went home angry. His family told him, "Why don't you build a massive set of gallows and then go tomorrow and ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows?" But God was at work. God was at work during that night. The king couldn't sleep. He was reading his records, and he realized Mordecai had saved his life and hadn't been rewarded. And the king needed to reward those who saved their lives. Otherwise, there would be no reason for people to want to preserve the life of the king. So he thought, "What can I do? I need to do something to honor this man." And it just so happens that the first person into court that day was Haman. But before Haman could say, "Mordecai, I want him hung on a gallows," the king said, "What should I do? What should the king do for the man who he delights to honor?" And Haman, filled with his own sense of importance, decided, "Who else could it be but me?" And so he comes up with this elaborate plan. He says, "Well, he should go on the king's horse. He should have the king's ring. He should have one of the king's servants parading him around the city." And the king says, "Go and do this for Mordecai." And at this point, Haman starts to recognize, oh no, what's happened here? And then as things progress throughout the day, it's discovered Haman's plan. And the servants of the king say, "We need to get rid of this guy. There's the gallows already built. You can hang him on those." He had prepared them just the day before, and then Haman ended up hanging from those gallows he had built for Mordecai. God will judge his enemies. God will judge his enemies. And his enemies, we see throughout the Bible. And as we've already mentioned, we need to think of ourselves. Because if we have been using our words in a harmful way, in a hurtful way, Maybe we've spoken out against God, but even as we speak out against our neighbors, we're guilty of sin against God. Enemies are a problem for which God provides a solution, for which God provides judgment. And when we think then, if we see ourselves in this passage, in this psalm, as those who are God's enemies, we need to think, what hope is there for us if God's judgment is certain, if God will mete out the punishment that is deserved? What are we to do? Those who oppose God's Son, we read of in Psalm 2, we're told to kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. And in Psalm 110, we read, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And later in the psalm, it says, the Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chiefs over the wide earth. He will drink from the brook by the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head. The Psalms point us to Christ. They point us to Christ, God's anointed Son, the one we are called to kiss, the one we are called to honor, the one who is going to make all of his enemies his footstool. Human history is all heading towards Christ making his enemies his footstool. And so that leads to fear for those who are wicked, those who are evildoers, those who are enemies of God. And as we move then into the New Testament, we think of another king, not King David, but King Jesus in the New Testament, whose enemies plotted against him. We see it early on in Mark's gospel. We see it in Mark chapter 3. Jesus has just healed a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. And then we read, the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. The Pharisees, who would have had no business with the Herodians, and yet they were both focused in their hatred towards Jesus, and they plotted and held counsel together as to how they could destroy Jesus. And then in Mark chapter 12, we're told that they were seeking to arrest him, but feared the people, for they perceived that he told the parable against them. So they left him and went away. And then they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to try and trap him in his talk. Even in those verses, we see their desire to attack from a position of ambush, a position of no fear, where they think, we don't want to attack now because the people might attack us. No, we need to pick our moment. They went on to try to trap him in his talk, to get accusations against him. Mark chapter 14, the chief priests, the scribes, were seeking how to arrest him by stealth, similar theme, and kill him. For they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar. Then we read, when it comes to his trial, the chief priests, the elders, took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. The chief priests accuse him of many things. The chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him released for them, and to have Barabbas released rather than Jesus. And then as Jesus hung on the cross, the chief priests, the scribes, mocked him to one another, saying, he saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. And those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Jesus faced accusation, plotting, words throughout his life, and especially in those final hours. The plotting, the scheming of the enemy, of the wicked, of evildoers. And we see all included, not just the scribes and the priest, those crucified with him. We see Gentiles mocking him, the Roman centurions. Everyone is against Jesus. And it's not just in the Gospels, but it's us as well. Before we became Christians, but for everyone who's not a Christian, we are against Jesus, enemies of God who need to be reconciled or else judged rightly. And so we see Jesus hanging there, defeated in this position of death. And yet that was not the end for him. No, he rose again to new life so that we can be reconciled to God. Enemies are not just judged, but enemies are a problem for which God provides a merciful solution. And even in Psalm 64, if we turn back there, we see in the final few verses, we see the response to God bringing his judgment, God shooting his arrow and wounding them suddenly. We see three groups of people at the end of this psalm. In verse 8, we see the enemies who are brought to ruin with their own tongues turned against them. Then in verse 9, we see all mankind who are watching on, seeing what God has done in the judging of enemies and recognizing that it is God who has brought about this situation, this pain, this destruction of enemies. And their response then is to fear, to recognize what God has done, and to ponder it. And the third group then are in verse 10, the righteous, those who are upright in heart. The righteous ones rejoice in the Lord. And so as we come to the conclusion of this psalm, the question for us is, who are we in this group? Are you still an enemy of God? An enemy who will face God's just judgment? Or as you have looked around you and seen other people die, other people suffer, other people reject Christ and move on, how do you respond to that? How do you respond when you recognize what God has brought about, what God has done even through the preaching of his word, even as we've looked at some of those stories like Haman, his wickedness being brought back on himself, or Daniel with the lion's den? And then there's those who are righteous and upright in heart, rejoicing because justice does come in the midst of facing suffering. And obviously this morning we thought about that with Richard in Matthew chapter 10, the suffering of persecution. Christ, through his death and resurrection, brings reconciliation, brings those who were enemies, while we were still God's enemies, we are brought, Romans 5 verse 8 tells us. But then what about us as Christians now, as we face maybe accusations from enemies as we go about our daily lives, our business? We think of Christ, the accusations against him, as we looked at some of those in Mark. We think of Christ being accused of having a demon. Think of the early Christians. They were accused of being cannibals, of being atheists, of being incestuous. The reason for this, cannibals, because of the Lord's Supper, eating bread and wine, the body and blood, that was confused. They were attacked as being cannibals. Incest, because of the language of brothers and sisters. And atheists, because they refused to worship many gods, but only worshipped one God. These false accusations brought against God's people. And what of the accusations that are brought against us today? Christians are bigots. Sure, Christians are hypocrites. Sure, Christians seem to be all about love, but then are harsh. As Christians, we do face challenges. We face accusations. We need to weigh those up. We need to think, yes, maybe there is something I need to think about there, but we need to recognize that this world has enemies, enemies against God's people. David brought this out a few weeks ago, in one of the Psalms. We face the enemies of the world, the flesh, and the devil. And our accusations come. And we need to fortify ourselves. We need to trust in God that even though enemies and evil may triumph for a time, God's justice, God's judgment is sure, is certain, and it will come. And in the meantime, we need to stand firm. We need to persevere We need to pray, entrusting judgment to God, as we see David do in this psalm. And we need to fix our eyes on Jesus, the one who has made us no longer enemies with God. Let us pray.